Hey everyone, I've got some exciting news for you. My brand new book, E-commerce Growth Strategy, a brand-driven approach to attract shoppers, build community, and retain customers is out now. Want to catapult your brand from obscurity to unstoppable? This is the guide you've been waiting for. Drawing from years on hands-on experience and insights from this podcast from over 400 episodes we've recorded, I've distilled everything into one essential playbook. Whether you're a founder, an e-commerce executive, or a C-suite bigwig, this book has got something for you. So head over to Amazon or any major book website and grab a copy. Let's turn those insights into bottom line growth. Your journey from zero to iconic starts here.
People that end up in logistics is usually just people that like to solve problems and like relentlessly improve programs, because in logistics, you're just never done. There's always something else that you can do to either improve service or reduce costs so that you can, you know, have positive impacts to the bottom line of the company. Influencers and affiliates to work with you on a commission basis, but most of them are just expecting to be paid up front nowadays, and that's just how the industry has evolved. So it would be very hard to have that as your main marketing or acquisition channel if you have a bootstrap company. The brand play is a very long tail where you don't necessarily are getting a bunch of sales or return on investment early on, but you see more of that when you start creating a name for the brand and people start to recognize it. But you know, you need multiple touch points to show you through the life cycle of a customer to convert them. If you're, if the first time that you're getting a hold of them is just through a brand play.
So in today's episode, we're going to get into the detail of how to ship perishable goods if you're running a D2C e-commerce brand. Great episode you don't want to miss, so do stay tuned.
This is the 2X e-commerce podcast, hosted by Kunle Campbell.
Hello, folks. Welcome to the 2X e-commerce podcast, and this is the podcast dedicated to rapid growth in online retail. I can't believe we're 9 years now. I remember recording the first episode in 2014, November of 2014, and we're in 2024 now. We're really growing strong. So come the end of this year, we'll be 10 years. But I digress. On today's episode, I wanted to sort of give insights to CPG brand teams and founders who are looking to get into the perishable space, so perishable product space. And by that, I mean products that need refrigeration or freezing, and kind of understand the logistics behind it. I found this really, really fascinating. So I did some research, and I found a logistics company called Grip Shipping, the 3PL company, and I got to speak with their founder, Juan Meisel, and he broke down the unit economics of it. He broke down why you should do it. He broke down how it's done, how to do it through marketplaces, how to do it through D2C. He himself was part of the founding team of ButcherBox. If you don't know ButcherBox, they're a $500 million in revenue business that sells just meat, beef, online, D2C, saw astronomical growth over COVID and retained a lot of the customers. So he got that background, and then he was head of logistics there, and he kind of understood what it means to essentially move, store, ship perishable goods, and he's doing it for the wider public. So super interesting conversation. One, I'll read his bio to you, and then you can just tune into this episode. So one, Marcel is the founder and CEO of Grip, a dynamic logistics company which has ensured the safe and on-time arrival of more than $1 billion worth of perishable D2C goods. Part of the founding team of ButcherBox, Marcel headed logistics for 6 years and helped the company scale from zero to $600 million in annual revenue. in 2022, he launched Grip, a data-driven platform that supplies D2C e-commerce brands with world-class logistics to help unlock their growth. This year, Grip was named South Florida Business Journal Startup of the Year, and Juan is a Forbes 30 Under 30 entrepreneur. So there you have it. Great episode if you are in the CPG space looking to essentially get into perishable goods. Enjoy the convo, last about 35 minutes. And yeah, enjoy this episode. Thank you. Juan, welcome to the 2X e-commerce podcast.
Thank you for having me.
Fantastic, fantastic, fantastic. I have to say that I'm pretty fascinated with, you know, what you're doing at Grip, given the fact that you're a special logistics company that you know, work with perishable products. We're going to talk a lot about it, but I really want to get to the precursor to where you are now to Grip. What is the backstory?
Yeah, absolutely. So, you know, my personal backstory, which helps explain what we've built at Grip and what we're doing now, is I joined ButcherBox, a company that does frozen meat online, as part of the very, very early team. And at ButcherBox, you know, at first it was all about marketing and branding. You know, how could we get our product out there? How could we get people to understand that they can buy a box of frozen meat and get it delivered to their doorstep? That was, you know, the first few years of the company. And after that, we realized that, like, hey, we're selling thousands of these, and you know, we now have to deliver them all across the country. And as a bootstrap company, there's really, you know, almost no room for error when you're operating at that scale and delivering boxes to your customers. So, you know, logistics internally very quickly became one of the biggest focus as a company, and then also the technology that paired that logistics for delivering boxes to people. So ButcherBox was scaled from zero to about $600 million in yearly revenue in the first 6 years as a company. And, you know, while doing that, we quickly realized that, hey, this logistics thing for perishable products in the mail, so direct-to-consumer e-commerce, it's really just not there where it needs to be. So the market has exponentially grown, and people now understand that they can buy frozen or perishable products in the mail, but the infrastructure is not developed for that in the back end. So we started to see that at ButcherBox, where we were spending, you know, millions of dollars to keep up with technology internally, and, you know, we're still using some Excel for some of the day-to-day job and work. And then I started advising other companies in the space, and I just saw that, you know, everyone had the same problems. Say, you know, I am wasting way too many efforts and resources in trying to figure out the logistics for my direct-to-consumer product, and I could just be using those resources in much more, you know, other better spent, you know, other better spent areas of the company, which could be the marketing and, you know, the product development. And, you know, when we saw that, it was just clear that with our experience at ButcherBox, it just makes so much sense for us to, you know, build this solution and build this infrastructure to allow other brands and other products to, you know, focus on their branding and focus on the product development. And we just handle all the back end of delivering products to people's doorsteps.
Interesting. So you were the head of logistics at ButcherBox, $600 million company for 6 years, for close to 6 years. So you oversaw that growth, you know, from start to finish. I think you're employee number four. How did you get into logistics?
You know, logistics itself, I would say that only about 5 to 10% of the people that end up in logistics actually think that they're going to end up in logistics and, you know, get ready for ending up in logistics or, like, go to school for something like that. It's usually the people that end up in logistics is usually just people that like to solve problems and, like, relentlessly improve programs, because in logistics, you're just never done. There's always something else that you can do to either improve service or reduce costs so that you can, you know, have positive impacts to the bottom line of the company. So I think that just happens to be my personality of, hey, let's, you know, improve on stuff and just keep working and understanding that things are just never perfect. So, you know, from that and just seeing so much area of improvement at ButcherBox, and then I had also started another company before that in South America. We were trying to be the Amazon of South America when I was, you know, pretty young and ambitious. So, you know, I had some experience in the industry when we had to set up all the logistics infrastructure for that, but I had moved away from it for the first year or so at ButcherBox when I was fully focused on, you know, getting people to understand that they can buy boxes of frozen meat online. So, you know, much more focused on the marketing and the messaging for the company. But the logistics just became a massive pain point for us. That's when I basically started to solve some of that problems and ended up running the department there.
So as I said earlier, I'm super excited to learn more about Grip and the perishable sort of logistics space, but you can't not have been 6 years in ButcherBox and we don't talk about ButcherBox. So tell me the story. It's incredible. I know it was like a blue ocean strategy, first to market, but they executed quite well. 0 to 600 million in 6 years or less. It's an incredible story. Do you want to sort of whittle it down into how you think they did it so it could inspire listeners?
Yeah, absolutely. And I even think that one of the major factors that are being left out here is that the company was bootstrapped. So we never ever raised a single dime.
It was bootstrapped to 600.
So that's like literally what's almost unheard of.
What was it? What do you think was the unfair advantage?
I mean, definitely the team. One, the team that we put together initially was extremely invested into the company and a very, you know, diverse backgrounds and just basically, you know, problem solvers, no bullshit. Let's just, you know, get to work and advance this thing together. And, you know, the timing of it also was very good. Because people were starting to understand, you know, that the type of meat that you eat is very important. And then also people were starting to understand that they can buy products frozen or refrigerated and get them delivered to their houses. So, you know, just pairing those things at the same time and then pair that with a very ambitious and hardworking team, that's basically what, you know, recipe for success for us early on. And, you know, a lot of work, of course, since day one, and there's a lot of different things that we were trying. But, you know, at first, for example, with our marketing strategy, we saw that, you know, using affiliates and influencers that were heavy on the clean eating space, that were heavy on the, you know, on the food ecosystem. We basically identify these people and we partner with them on a win-win scenario where we help them sell ButcherBox and we would give them a commission and we would pay them based on how many boxes they were selling. And a lot of them end up just, you know, making $100,000+ just from selling butcher boxes as well. So, you know, defining a very clear marketing strategy and just doubling down on what was working for us helped us through the first few years. And, you know, the fact that we were bootstrapped also, I think, played a very key role for us because that just made us, you know, find solutions and think outside the box when it comes to, you know, what were other people not doing that it could be some type of arbitrage opportunity for us and find value in those arbitrage opportunities. So, you know, that's why we decided to double down on somewhat unconventional marketing methods at the time. And, you know, I'm speaking eight years ago. At the time, like, for example, you know, paying on commission to affiliates and just basically having them almost be part of the team and help them sell ButcherBox.
I was speaking to someone today. He's a 25-year veteran in e-commerce. And it was like affiliate marketing today has kind of transitioned to influencer marketing. It's evolved to influencer marketing. So some of those principles still hold true. It's just the way we refer it in the medium, really. So in the first 24 months of business,
I was just going to expand on that. You know, it's completely different nowadays. I think that you can still get some influencers and affiliates to, you know, work with you on a you know, commission basis, but most of them are just expecting to be paid up front nowadays. Mm-hmm. And that's just how the industry has evolved. So it will be very hard to have that as your main marketing or acquisition channel if you have a bootstrap company.
So you need that capital for influencers to test, mm-hmm, essentially, because there's no guarantee that a collaboration will go well.
Correct.
Yeah. And a lot of people are still quite brand focused from influencer marketing standpoint rather than performance. What were your thoughts on that?
I mean, it works if you have a bunch of capital to test and spend for that because the brand play is a very long tail where you don't necessarily are getting a bunch of sales or return on investment early on, but you see more of that when you start creating a name for the brand and people start to recognize it. But, you know, you need multiple touch points to show you through the life cycle of a customer to convert them. If you're, if the first time that you're getting a hold of them is just through a brand play.
So given the fact that, you know, you're operating, you know, Grip, you founded and operating Grip. What is the landscape now for perishable products? You know, so a lot of CPG brands have, I remember over the pandemic, I used to buy, it was an ice cream, one of these, low calorie ice creams. And after the pandemic, like 9 months after the pandemic, they wrote us a letter saying that they had to do what they had to do over the pandemic, but it was not making commercial sense. And then they directed us to the grocery stores they stock it in, and they haven't ever come back online. I'm not sure if that has changed yet, but that the last time I checked, that was the situation. In your view, what is the landscape, particularly in North America? Because I'm speaking on, you know, I'm speaking to an English company, to a British company. But in North America, what is the landscape now with a perishable goods space and people who are looking to launch products in CPG that essentially need a certain cooling, level, temperature?
Yeah, so what you described, the situation that you described, we have definitely seen it happen here in the U.S. market as well, where there's companies that have, you know, outstanding product, they have an audience that is ready to buy from them, but just because they're not logistics or operations company, they can't really figure out the back half after they sell the product, which is how do I get it to my consumer's doorstep in a way that it makes sense from, you know, an operational cost and an ROI standpoint. And more often than not, they can't figure it out by themselves because it's a very complex problem, especially when you're shipping perishables in the mail. So we've seen that happen with some brands. Unfortunately, we have seen other brands, which is great to see that, as an example, when they work with someone with us, they understand now that they can, you know, decrease the cost by, you know, almost 50% of what they were doing before, and also increase the probability of success when delivering the box, where we've seen them turn it back on, which for us is super exciting because the consumer is there. Like, the consumer behavior has changed. You know, if you talk 10 years ago, it was not that normal to get something frozen delivered to your doorstep. And that's what happened to us when we were getting started at ButcherBox, where we first had to convince people that it was completely fine to get something delivered to your doorstep. Nowadays, it's common knowledge. You know, almost everybody knows it. If you ask around, almost everybody has gotten something refrigerated or frozen delivered to the houses. So, like, the consumer behavior, the market is there for that. Now we just have to pair the logistics capabilities of all these brands to meet where the consumer is, which is a much simpler and easier problem to solve. You know, still complex, but much simpler than trying to convince the customer that getting it is fine. So we've seen the market evolve where it's much easier now to launch the products, but you need to really have a nailed down logistics and operations strategy and infrastructure, and also mostly with technology to be able to meet the consumer where they are.
Let's take a short pause to hear from our sponsors and we'll be right back. Hey, e-commerce trailblazers, ready for a game changer in your podcast lineup? I've got just the thing. Tread Secrets, a new podcast that's all about giving you the operational edge in e-commerce. Let's cut straight to the chase. Unlike most e-commerce podcasts that dwell on marketing and growth stories, Tread Secrets dives deep into the operational heart of e-commerce. This is where the real magic happens. Why tune in? Because Tread Secrets brings you the nuts and bolts of e-commerce success. We're talking the nitty-gritty of inventory hacks, cash flow management, sales strategies, supply chain intricacies, product sourcing secrets, and the ins and outs of financing. It's the operational wisdom you need to keep your business not just running, but thriving. hosted by Peter Beckman, CEO of Tread. This podcast is a treasure trove of insights from industry experts and successful e-commerce practitioners. It's like having a roundtable of mentors, each sharing their best kept operational secrets. Don't let this opportunity slip through your fingers. Search for Tread Secrets on your favorite podcast app or visit tread.io/podcast. That's TREYD.io/podcast. Hit the subscribe button and stay ahead of the dynamic world of e-commerce. Remember, it's TREYD Secrets, the podcast where e-commerce operations meet success. Tune in now and transform the way you do business. Yeah. So what is the process in, so I could sell phone cases, and the phone cases could be in a warehouse for years. Oh, you don't want to do that. You want to have a high sell through or inventory turnover. How many days worth of inventory would a brand kind of, say, brand selling ice cream, kind of want to have, you know, with the providers such as yourselves or Grip?
So I'm going to split that into two different subcategories. One of them is refrigerated. The other one is frozen. So refrigerated products have a much shorter shelf life than the frozen products. So usually brands that are selling refrigerated products can only really have products in inventory for a week or 2 weeks at max. Because of, you know, almost like storing lettuce. If you're storing lettuce, you can't really have lettuce, sit for a bunch of days there because it's just going to go bad and you're going to have a lot of shrink. And then that's going to, of course, impact how much capital you need to be allocating to inventory. On the frozen side, it's much, much simpler because you can keep basically product, you know, extremely cold at -5 or -10 degrees Fahrenheit, and you can keep it, in inventory for months. Now, a lot of the products and companies only really keep them in inventory for a few weeks or a month, but that's just because they want to be efficient with their capital and also because storing frozen products is expensive. You know, using freezer space is expensive. So a lot of companies are just rotating inventory very fast, but on an inventory management side for frozen products is just much simpler than refrigerated. And sometimes people actually think that handling refrigerated products is simpler because it doesn't have to be as cold. But the problem with refrigerated is that there's a range of temperature where you need to be at. So you can't really be above, let's call it 40 degrees, and you can't really be under 32 degrees. So you only really have, you know, let's call it 6 to 8 degrees of where you can be. With a frozen product, as long as you are, you know, like at frozen temperatures, then you can basically keep it for a bunch of weeks.
Got it. Makes a lot of sense. And where are you seeing the demand? Where are CPG brands gravitating towards? Refrigerated or frozen?
So we see frozen. So frozen is just more sustainable because pairing demand and supply internally is much, much simpler. If you are a growing company and you're running a bunch of tests and promotions, like, you don't really have a great hold of what demand is going to look like for the next week or the next 4 weeks, because you might be running a promotion that you don't really know how is it going to perform. So, you know, for that reason, if you have frozen, you can just keep it. If you don't sell it that week, you're going to sell it the week after. But in the refrigerated side, you can't really do that. You have to stock up on the product, and if the promotion doesn't work, then you're going to have a bunch of excess inventory, which is going to end up being shrink. So from a capital standpoint, the frozen is much, much more efficient. But, you see both. You see both. The refrigerated side is growing, and the frozen side is growing as well.
Does this mean that there's an opportunity? Well, not really. I was going to say it was an opportunity for drinks. But when you think about cans can be stored in room temperature. And then when you open them, that's when they need to have a certain temperature. So that question goes out to the water. But
Actually not. Let me actually cut you there. We've seen also an increase in the market of drinks that need to be refrigerated because they have no preservatives. And that is, you know, an exponentially growing market as well. So you have, you know, natural drinks or juices that, you know, could be protein or just natural juices or smoothies that need to be refrigerated. And if you actually go to the supermarket aisles and to the refrigerated area, you'll now see drinks in there that are in just, you know, regular plastic or glass bottles that were not there before.
True. What about the ready meal space?
Also growing, you know, subcategories as well. The refrigerated localized deliveries, but then you have the frozen where you can get nationwide since day one. Or you also have the refrigerated where you can also get nationwide. But, you know, there's a bunch of different strategies that you can do there from a logistics standpoint, which is, you know, running line hauls directly into the different sorting centers from carriers to basically expedite the shipments. Or if you have enough capital, then you can go and, you know, distribute inventory across multiple facilities so that you can get closer to where the customer is. But we see, you know, high-end premium frozen ready-to-eat brands exponentially growing in the market. And some of them go towards the convenience. Some of them go towards a specific diet, or some of them go towards just say, this is very nice food to have at my house that I would also get at a restaurant, for example. So, you know, you have a bunch of different subcategories in there, but it's a market that is exponentially growing. And I think it's mostly just because a consumer understood that, hey, you know, I can get these amazing meals that are produced in Minnesota or New York or wherever, and I can just get them delivered in Florida to my house.
Yeah, it's a very exciting time to be in CPG in the refrigerated space, because the only play back in the, well, literally a few years ago was essentially grocery stores, right?
Correct. Right. That's the evolution that we've seen on the market.
Okay, then ButcherBox, was just to clarify, was ButcherBox only frozen meat, or did they sort of have like fresh meat?
Just frozen and just direct to consumer. So still to this date, you know, the company is trying out a couple of retail places, but still to this date, it's mostly just direct to consumer, and it is 100% frozen.
Gotcha. Okay, so with regards to what you're doing at Grip, can you? You don't need to mention names, or if you can, if you're allowed to mention names, that's fine. Could you describe the playbook of a customer of Grip that has done phenomenally well, that surprised you, that surprised your team, as to just the way they were able to execute their go-to-market strategy and keep you busy and their customers happy?
Yeah, of course. There's, you know, we have different subcategories of products, right? So we have, as an example, we have human-grade pet food, which, you know, includes dogs and cats mostly. That market is doing phenomenally well. We see it all across the market, and we see you know, new brands pop up, and we see old brands still keeping up with growth. So that's, you know, great market segment that has great retention as well, because, you know, once your pet starts eating a specific type of food, you can't really take it away from them that easily. And there's been, you know, great results as well in terms of pet health and, you know, happiness of the pets when you switch them into a frozen or a fresh diet. So that market is growing phenomenally well. The other thing that you have is the specialty foods market, which is something that you would basically like go to a very specific store to get, or could only buy from someone specific, where you had to be physically in the space to buy it, but you can now get it nationwide. So as an example, if there's a specific cake that's baked in New York City, you can now be in California and get it. Or if there's some type of, you know, quesadilla product or tortilla product that is made in California, you can now be in New York City and get it. So we see brands that have a, you know, very strong product or niche product that, you know, 5-10 years ago was just not possible to do this, but now with technology and having inventory distributed through a couple of facilities, they can now get nationwide with it. And then, as I was saying, the frozen or fresh, you know, premium ready-to-eat brands, it's also an exponentially growing market because of the convenience factor, because of you know, the specific products, or some people just like, you know, specific food, so they go to their one provider where they get their products. And in terms of how that looks from a success story is, you know, usually when we start working with brands, when you look under the hood in terms of what they're doing, it's very fragmented. So they're using multiple technology providers, they're using multiple, you know, broken systems on in Excel and, you know, Notion or whatever other Excel or spreadsheet they use internally. And then they're also using, you know, multiple facilities or partners across the country that they don't really have connected within the same, you know, data flow or ecosystem. So how it looks for us is we simplify that whole thing. So we basically say, hey, wherever you sell the product, we're basically going to grab the orders from there. And then everything is going to live within the same ecosystem. And we're also going to do dynamic decisions based on how the network is looking right now in terms of temperatures, on-time deliveries, major weather events, what type of product you're shipping, what insulation we can use, what size of box. And we're going to use that all those facts. We're going to look at all those factors and we're going to dynamically decide what's the best way to ship your box from point A to point B. So, you know, once you look at what they were doing before and what they can do now, that basically then allows them to shift the focus as a company, as I was saying before, and not spend that many or that much resources into logistics and operations, and they don't really have to think about fulfillment. So that basically gives them a lot of more resources to then spend it in growing the brand, in marketing, in technology internally for the front end of the website, in things that really allow them to grow. So, you know, we've seen exponential growth with a lot of our customers where, you know, a lot of them for the last year have, you know, even 4x or 5x their companies, even when, you know, it's generally been a flat market for, you know, a lot of other brands and industries out there. And there's really not a lot of, you know, capital going into some of these markets nowadays. But you still can see these companies when they gain efficiencies and they produce better margins, they can just keep exponentially growing.
Yeah. So yeah, that makes a lot of sense. So them not having to think about the last mile for a perishable product is critical for them to, it just unlocks a lot of time and resources for them to really grow the business, which makes a lot of sense. So marketplaces, has this opened up opportunity? What's Amazon's position here, thoughts? Because prior, you've not really been able to buy frozen products from apart from Amazon Fresh. What does Amazon look like, given the fact that 50% of all e-commerce transactions, consumer e-commerce transactions occur on Amazon?
So Amazon does not touch the product when it comes to frozen or refrigerated, as you said, other than Amazon Fresh. So they don't actually handle the logistics or the shipping of it for these type of products.
Can you list on Amazon and then fulfill through Grip?
Correct. So that's what we're seeing in the market. We see our brands that just go in Amazon, they list the products, they sell them through Amazon, and then they do the fulfillment through Grip with our technology as well.
Are you Amazon Prime accredited?
We're not yet. It's a process that we're going through right now. With a couple of partners, but we're not yet Amazon Prime accredited. But regardless, you can basically meet all the delivery times in 1 day and 2 days with you know, connecting through us and working through us. So, and for more context there, we get to 60% of the country in 1 day time in transit, and to the remaining 40%, or actually 39.2% in 2 days, and then 0.8% in 3 days. So
your fulfillment centers are spread across
anywhere in the country at under 2 days.
Yeah, your fulfillment, you have the fulfillment. Where are your fulfillment centers?
We're in Jersey, Texas, and the West Coast for the major ones, and then we have another one in Florida as well.
Got it. Unit economics. I'd like to how does it, because I noticed, like, for frozen, at least frozen is a category I'm familiar with. Actually, even I've noticed for frozen and refrigerated that first the packaging is insulated, very special insulation. Sometimes it'll have like an aluminium sort of lining in the inside, and the specification for the boxes are thicker, much more sturdy. They're harder to sort of compress. I'm a recycle guy. I'm the dustbin guy in my house, so I'm always clearing stuff out. So they're tougher to sort of flatten. Do you want to speak to all of that, or the more technical bits in that, and what it costs, what it typically costs? You know, just for listeners to have an understanding, please.
Yeah, totally. So you have, you know, shipping perishables in the mail is generally very expensive. So it has a lot of fixed costs that goes into it. which is why we advise our customers and partners to always try to have the highest average order value that they can, so that they can afford, you know, paying for all these expenses that you need to pay for when you're trying to get a box or something frozen from, you know, point A to point B. So to expand on that, you have basically, you know, the cost of the box, which is generally a high quality box and a, you know, decent size. You're talking about 12 cube or maybe 16 cube box that goes out. You have the insulation, which, you know, is also expensive. You have the refrigerant, which if it's frozen, you're generally dealing with dry ice. If it's refrigerated, you're dealing with gel packs. And then you have the fulfillment, which, you know, again, frozen and refrigerated warehouses are expensive. So the real estate to be there inside there is expensive. And then you also have the shipping cost, which you're usually not doing a USPS or some other, you know, slow service, because you need to be at your customer's doorstep in 1, 2 days, or 3 days at max. So when you add all these, you know, you're looking at fixed expenses that if you add a few more items to that box, or, you know, you increase your average order value, you're not necessarily exponentially increasing the cost of getting that box out. You know, maybe you're adding a few more picks to that box, which is going to cost some cents, or you're adding a little bit more weight, which is going to cost more on the shipping cost side, but a lot of the expenses are going to be there regardless. So, you know, we've seen, for example, that some of the companies that we start working with, they could have an average, you know, expense for operations and logistics of, let's call it, you know, $40, just to give an example of, you know, just shipping that box with everything that it entails. And we can break it down to, you know, $30, $25, just depending on where the box is going. So the amount, it's so expensive that the amount that you can save if you're doing things right, it, you know, it equals life or death for a lot of these companies, because you can, if you have an average order value of, you know, let's call it $100, and you bring that down from $40 to $30, then like that $10 could be the 10% that's like literally your net margin, or that could be the amount of money that you're losing if you want to break even in your company. So we see that it's just extremely important for all these brands to bring the cost down, just because of how expensive it is generally. And this is something that we were able to do at ButcherBox, just because how focused we were on cost and how much technology we were also able to build there because of the bootstrap component of the company. But we've worked with brands where we literally, you know, like flip the unit economic on its head and make them profitable when they were losing money on every shipment before.
So it's really a volume. If you can encourage customers to buy larger volumes than they used to for the pantry, not really the pantry because it's going to go into the freezer, but for their freezers and their refrigerators, they really need to buy more. Hence the reason why frozen is a better proposition most of the time, right? I would think, yeah.
Yeah, you hit it on the head. That's correct. Because, you know, you don't really want to have a month worth of refrigerated product, because it's probably going to go bad.
Yeah. They're probably better off using an Instacart to get their refrigerated products, and then for their frozen stock, you know, they can really, really, you know, sort of get a good stock, or, you know, get good stuff for their frozen, you know, products. It makes a lot of sense. Okay. Do you have any tips, any launch tips? So there will be a cross section of listeners enjoying this conversation now who already selling products, you know, they're selling non-refrigerated products, non-frozen products already, you know, and they're looking to move in. What would you say their 90-day launch plan should look like, you know, if they're trying to launch their refrigerated or frozen products, you know, online to start selling e-commerce profitably?
So I would say, you know, first, of course, you know, figure out a product that, you know, people want to buy from you. Just because they're buying non-refrigerated stuff doesn't necessarily mean that, you know, they're going to buy the refrigerated stuff from the same brand. So, you know, first validate that in the first couple of weeks. Then after that, I would really define the strategy of the product being, you know, refrigerated or frozen specifically, which you know, from this conversation, you can already tell that I definitely advise towards frozen versus refrigerated, but, you know, refrigerated can also be done and it can be done profitably as well. And then, you know, I would understand basically where is the product produced and where do I have to get it to get closer to the customer and start fulfillment processes. So depending on the volume and how much capital you have for the inventory and if it's frozen or refrigerated, then I would advise towards one or a couple fulfillment centers to start with, just so that you get a handle of the inventory turnaround and, you know, all the shipping of the product to your final customer and how that works. And then after that, once you understand where your specific buyers are, I would then go into further optimizing that by opening new sites or new facilities across the country that can then move you away from air shipments into ground shipments. Because, you know, air shipments, you can be, you know, $40 to $50 average just on the shipping costs. And then ground, you know, you can be, let's say, $15 average on the shipping costs. So it's, you know, night and day when it comes to how much you're paying to get the product to your customer, depending if you're doing ground or air shipments. And I wouldn't advise towards doing more than 3 days on the ground. And also, of course, you know, depending on the product, if you're doing something like meat, you know, meat itself, it's very dense. So you can have it frozen for longer than if you're doing, let's say, a juice or a smoothie or fruit that defrosts faster than meat. So that's why I say, you know, like, you know, focus on defining what type of product is, and then from there you can define what the launch strategy is looking like when it comes to the logistics and fulfillment.
Well, this sounds like a perfect plan. Hmm. What do you think is the size of this opportunity for perishable goods D2C?
Massive. You know, it's exponentially growing. And COVID actually helped accelerate that. For some brands, it came down after COVID, but not to pre-COVID levels. You know, I'll give you the ButcherBox example. You know, ButcherBox grew 100% year over year in COVID. So I think we were doing around 200 million in yearly revenue before COVID. And right, you know, the couple of years after COVID or the year after COVID, we're at 400 million annualized revenue. So, and, you know, the company kept most of those customers. And the reason for that is because the consumer now understands that they can buy food online and it gets delivered to their houses. And, you know, COVID, just because everyone was at home, helped accelerate that change of mindset. So, you know, the change of mindset is here to stay, just because it's an understanding of customers. They now understand that they can do this versus, you know, 8 or 10 years ago. So definitely bullish on the industry. And then when you take that and you pair it with what we built and the technology for shipping the actual products to the mail and making it sustainable, then that's just, you know, recipe for success for all these brands.
Juan, it's been an absolute pleasure having you on the 2X e-commerce podcast. For people who want to find out more about Grip Shipping, it's gripshipping.com. I'll link to it in the show notes. Are you active on any social media platforms?
I'm active on LinkedIn through my personal one, and then the company is also active on LinkedIn. You know, you can find me, Juan C. Meso, on LinkedIn or the company. And then I reopened my Twitter account after about 15 years of not being in there a couple months ago. So I've been doing some posting there as well.
We'll link to all social platforms. It's been very, very insightful for me just learning about this space. And I'm sure the audience would have really enjoyed it. And, you know, just I really want to open up opportunities to people, you know, just to widen the perspective on opportunities. And I think this one was a very special one. So thank you, Juan. And yeah, best luck with Grip Shipping.
Yeah, of course. Thank you for having me. And, you know, happy to be here.
Cheers.